Today is May 19th, 2014. This is the follow-up interview with Paul Buell. Again, this is a phone interview. We are both in Madison at two separate locations. That's why it's called a phone interview. And Paul, for sound quality purposes, could you say your name and spell your last name?
Sure. Paul Buell, last name spelled B-U-H-L-E.
Great. Thank you. So, as I said before we turn the recorder on, have a like six or seven questions over the next 50 minutes. We'll see how far we get.
Very good.
So the first one is, what was Professor Williams like to work with?
Well, my actual work with him was limited in the sense that I was able to take one course. It was an undergraduate survey course in modern diplomatic history, but it also had a section for graduate students. And the way that we were differentiated from undergraduates was that we needed to do a longer research paper, and that meant coming into his office and chatting with him. This was significant for several ways for me. The first one was that he was really affable and kindly, and not with me, not grouchy at all, as he could be sometimes, maybe when he was hungover. But also that we don't talk about my research paper, whatever kinds of research I was doing, but I also asked him about a grant for my magazine, Radical America, and the place that I knew was giving grants to left-wing activities, socially critical activities and publications, that is to say, the Rabinowitz Foundation. And he said he would write a letter to them. And indeed, this very small and financially hard-pressed publication got $1,000 from them, which meant a whole lot in 1968 or 69, whatever year that came through. So in many ways, it was wonderful listening to him in class. The class was huge, and he was a wonderful lecturer and all those things. And secondly, he welcomed me as a publisher of a magazine succeeding Studies in the Left, you might say, but also as a young person who was politically serious and also scholarly about the task of researching and writing history.
Great. Thank you, Paul.
Are you bothered at all by this, by any background noise?
No, to me,
I can hear it, but I think it's only temporary.
Okay, to me, all I can hear is
closed doors away.
All right, to me, I can only hear you. So
very good.
And I think in a subsequent interview, probably our last interview, we'll talk more about your book about Williams. But I think we'll leave that for a subsequent interview. So. Well, maybe we'll start this. Maybe we'll start this way. Then we want to talk a little bit about your teaching and research experience. Maybe we'll start by asking. So, what do you recall the paper that you had to write for that class?
Boy, I wish I did. It may have been finding a document and in diplomatic history and then analyzing it. You know, reprinting such as we did, probably typing it out or making a Xerox or something, and then reprinting it. I mean, then writing a 500-word commentary. That's probably the only thing that I can think of that it might have been.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about your teaching, if any, that you did in graduate school.
Sure. Well, maybe it's easier to start with the historical society stuff because that was my first semester, I believe. At UW in the fall of 1967, and that would have been working in the fourth floor of the Historical Society, Wisconsin State Historical Society, then processing papers of a union that was seeking to organize successfully in the South in the 1940s. That would be one of the textile unions, and it was a great job because the other archivists were serious about history. There was a former victim of the blacklist who'd been able to, was a local left-wing guy who was able to get a job at the Historical Society, which he wouldn't have been able to otherwise in many parts of state or private employment. I did not that I spoke with him, but people talked about him, And my supervisors were very kindly, and I learned some important details of processing papers, constructing dates, trying to figure out what the last names of writers of letters were, with who didn't have the last names, all the sort of stuff of how do you work with documentation, paper documentation, and make it usable by future patrons. So that was just great. By the second semester, but more likely by the second year, by the fall of 1968, I was cheerfully plunged into the classroom as a teaching assistant. And it was perfectly fine. It was a fascinating time to be a teaching assistant because there was still so much ferment on campus from the previous year, the Dow demonstration, the police riot, and the subsequent strike and so forth. And I tried to blend 20th century history U.S. into the present in the sense of asking students to respond to the question, what did they know historically a year later about the Dow incident? How did they understand some part of current history? And they had all kinds of different views and opinions, and also they had a sense of their own participation in a historical event, which is quite an unusual sort of thing for an 18-year-old to take on. But it made history seem a great deal more interesting and intimate than it would normally, and then they could project backward in a better or more interested fashion as to how one might understand historical events and personalities in the past. That's my largest memory of that class, but it was as through my all my teaching in Madison 1968 to 71, the students were just excellent, better than I've ever known since, and they felt that they were changing history or might change history, and so history meant more to them than history would mean subsequently in my teaching career.
So a couple of questions about your teaching then. So was it primarily 20th century U.S. history?
It was entirely 20th century U.S. history.
Okay. And who, so UTA, did you?
I should amend that by saying that it might have been post-Civil War to the present, so a bit, 30 years of 19th century history. And who were my, who did I TA for? At least once, it was for William O'Neill. But once I'll need to consult my wife, who is Paul Richards, lead professor of the economics at Durham, Mort Rothstein.
Okay, thank you.
Bit of an economic historian, yes, he was entirely an economic historian, I'm corrected to say.
Okay.
I would say was, enjoyed being gruff. He was a former longshoreman, so he liked being difficult, but actually he was pretty much okay, and William O'Neill was surrounded by young radical students in his classes and eager not to offend them. So all in all, I had a very pleasant time.
Okay. Do you recall any undergraduates that you taught that you ended up finding out more about later on, becoming friends with?
Of all those, I would say Leo Burt would be the only exception. Leo Burt being the only person from the Army Math Research Center bombing that never turned up and we presume is dead. Other than that, did I later find out anything about my undergraduates? Yes, I'm quite incorrect. There's a labor historian in Pennsylvania whose name does not occur to me, and I might not be able to find it, but he's worked on environmental effects in the workplace, and he most definitely was an undergraduate student of mine.
Okay. And so are you saying that you taught Leo Burt, but really it was after the fact that you...
Of course. Of course. No, my recollection, as I've often said since then, is that in the spring of 1970, it was William O'Neill had a course on radicalism, which was quite a chaotic course because it was so huge and his knowledge of the subject wasn't comprehensive, but we're very energetic teaching assistants, including Mary Jo, who's probably in the best group of undergraduates because they wanted to learn about women's history. It was very exciting and new. Leobert was the columnist for the Cardinal on sports, and he seemed to be politically sympathetic, but not deeply political, and probably wasn't involved in any kind of student organization or anything. He was a sort of average young enthusiast who was capable of doing the wrong or at least the very foolish thing because the war was grinding on and tens and hundreds of thousands were being killed for no reason. Did I know anything about his involvement with these other people? No, nothing whatsoever. He just appeared in class and he spoke up sometimes, not a lot, but he seemed like an affable kid, and that's my entire Leobert experience.
Okay, thank you for that. So you talked last time about it was really your cohorts, your graduate students, that you had the closest bonds with, and I'm not sure I asked you specifically which ones influenced your life the most, so I wonder if you would talk a little bit about some of your cohort.
Happy to do so. Well, before Mary Jo and I moved to Madison in late August 1967, Jim O'Brien, a real central figure in SDS and still a leading figure in Historians Against War to this very day, had been in touch with me. I think he also was involved in this project of internal education in SDS. And consequently, when he heard that I was seeking to launch a magazine that would be directed mostly to SDSers, he was quite interested. He met with me at a summer conference of some kind. So we were already in touch. And as I got there, he arranged for a place for Mary Jo and I to stay a couple nights until we got an apartment, which was in fact the rented house on near next to the railroad tracks, where Henry Hoslock and his wife lived. Of course, Francis Court, really falling apart shacks next to the railroad tracks, but quite accommodating in some ways. The screens weren't very comprehensive against flies or mosquitoes, but leaving that detail aside, I was instantly, Mary Jo too, welcomed into this graduate student world. Henry Hoslock, a leading figure in the TAA effort, was a math graduate student, so I didn't really know him very well except that he was around and had been a leading figure in SDS. He was sort of easing out of that into the TAA work. But Jim O'Brien was, from that moment, and would continue to be through our lives in Madison and our early time in Somerville, a real central figure. He was willing and eager to do anything in terms of the footwork that needed to be done, and eager for a conversation about what might be done in internal education. And I believe not only did he run a couple of study classes, one notable one on labor within SDS or among graduate students that included SDS sympathizers, more graduates than undergraduates, but if I'm not wrong, he'd actually arranged the publication of a couple of pamphlets by Madison SDS the year previous. So he was the energetic center of graduate self-education reading and discussing existing scholarly works and trying to make radical sense of them in some kind. There are a host of other radical-minded history graduate students, most not all in U.S. history, that we were closely in touch with. A larger number were European history, Goldberg, Mossy students, and so forth, but the ones we knew best, were likely to know best, were in U.S. history. And at least at that moment, the one that appeared immediately to me, also went to SDS meetings, was Anne Gordon, who later would play a prominent role in the papers of women suffrage leaders, but was a very skillful, determined activist who was wonderful to talk with about these serious subjects. and for a while was editor of the newspaper, The Connections, after Robert Gabriner and its other founders left town. So she was a real central person in many ways, and I can't think of anyone else besides herself and Jim O'Brien, who were SDSers, graduate students, who were so much on top of what was going on.
Well, since you mentioned SDS a couple of times, Paul, I wonder if you could talk about your involvement with SDS here.
Well, it's an interesting question, because back in Madison, as I think we covered, or back in Champaign, as I think we covered in an earlier conversation, SDS chapter was so new and so relatively small that I plunged into it in the fall of 1965 and became a spokesman for it very shortly. The SDS chapter, University of Connecticut in Storrs, was so limited, unsuccessful in a campus of commuter students, that if I could create an event with a popular speaker, that would be a big deal, but the chapter didn't really function very well. It was one of those very weak chapters. By contrast to that, the chapter in Madison was very, very large and vital from the moment I stepped in. And I was happy to be there and happy to speak and around and discuss things with these students, but I didn't find myself particularly necessary. There were plenty of people who were much better speakers than I who would stay late for these very long meetings discussing anti-war strategies in the ballroom of the union. And my role was sort of seemed to be to take a step back and publish the magazine Radical America while being active with everybody else in more or less important, limited ways in the TAA effort and all the other things that were going on campus. So, you know, I would describe myself at this stage in Madison as a fairly average graduate student within SDS, because in a successful campus, SDS was overwhelmingly undergraduate students, and the graduate students were these older people who came around but didn't want to impose themselves or dominate the activity of what was going on. And the other crucial factor is that in some campuses there had been almost no political activity on the leftward side until SDS. That certainly was true in Illinois, and it certainly was true in Connecticut, but in Madison, the anti-war peacenik activity directed toward campus and directed toward the community was long-standing, pretty significantly popular, and so SDS was a latecomer, and its role was valuable, but only within this very much larger mix of events on campus.
Thank you, Paul. Just jotting down a note here. So, you mentioned earlier about, you know, discussions you would have with Henry Hazlick or Jim O'Brien or some of your other cohort. Where would these discussions take place?
I have one more footnote on that last question.
Okay.
Because it just occurs to me.
Okay.
In later years, I happened to be on a train with Evan Stark between New York and New Haven, and he remarked to me that SDS had been created in quotes, on the campus in Madison because the Committee to End the War in Vietnam was at loggerheads with itself. It had been divided between people who thought it was necessary to work within the Democratic Party locally and people who thought it was terrible to work within the Democratic Party locally. And that would be people who were sympathetic toward the broad sort of popular front descended from the Communist Party a long time earlier, and the people who were close to the Socialist Workers Party, the Trotskyists, who opposed anything within the Democratic Party. But these people had been sort of arguing with each other, mostly in a friendly way, for at least 5 years on campus, and they were directed outward toward the community more than campus itself. Someone perceived the need for a group of undergraduates who were free of this older set of arguments and were directed specifically toward campus. And according to his account, other people had encouraged the creation, or you might say recreation, of an SDS chapter, because SDS had existed intermittently on the UW campus from its founding in 1961, but had never been central in any way whatsoever. And now it was going to be very important, if not necessarily central, between 1967 and 1969. But it may be important in the way that mainly that it transcended the limitations of earlier anti-war activities. That's my footnote.
Okay.
Now, what was the next question?
The question was, you referenced earlier in the graduate student question about having discussions with some of your cohorts, and I'm wondering where these discussions took place.
Before and after SDS meetings at the Union, most definitely at discussion groups that Jim O'Brien had convened on labor history and other subjects. Corporate liberalism would be another example of people discussing something, and there was another study circle of on Marx and Marxism that I wasn't part of. But mainly, I think people ran into each other in the Historical Society.
Okay, so like the reading room of the Historical Society?
Yeah, I think so, or, you know, in other words, not to disturb anyone else, walking outside if the weather was okay and having a chat, or stepping over into the Memorial Union.
Okay. Thank you. So since we're talking about Memorial Union, and you mentioned Memorial Union, so I want to talk about a little bit more about the Rathskeller.
Uh-huh.
And what you might see as its importance in terms of student activism on campus.
Well, since many a young person came to Madison out of state, or at least as far as Illinois would be concerned, like myself, although I wasn't an undergraduate, the appeal of beer and the Rathskeller definitely it seems to have been an historical factor. But I think that the Rathskeller in chilly weather and the Terrace in warm weather were places that young anti-war people would not only mix with each other, but also mix with their professors. I always had this impression that Harvey Goldberg would gather a group of students around, let's say on the terrace, and would hold court, and that he wasn't the only one. That this was a place outside of the classroom, anywhere in the Union, any of those three places in where professors who were popular and charismatic and so forth would sort of carry on the Socratic dialogue and be enjoyed greatly, and the students loved to respond to them, et cetera, et cetera. I didn't happen to be part of any of those circles, perhaps because we graduate students were a world unto ourselves, but I knew that they existed.
Okay. Another place that the book Rads, Bates in the book Rads, mentions a lot as a place where people would get together and talk about things was a Nitty Gritty, and I'm wondering if you personally ever hung out there.
No. There's a wonderful anecdote somebody sent me about the Madison left in the 1950s around studies in the left. It was Michael Lebowitz, who was still around and was part of the study circle, and he said James Weinstein was unique among us because he lived away from campus and had a car, which is to say, in the period just before Mary Jo and I arrived, everybody lived near campus and nobody had a car. Madison had just reached the stage where people were living in the East Side, where the East Side came to be seen as a viable place to live. I don't think anybody lived anywhere else. Somebody occasionally would hear about renting a house west of the city, but in Middleton, one of fellow graduate student actually did, but that was considered bizarre. Nobody had actually been to Middleton, and likewise Verona and all these other places. Oh yeah, one other graduate student, Peter Wiley, lived in Sun Prairie, which was a very small town. because he owned a dog and wanted to have a house with a yard, but these were unique circumstances. By the time we moved to State Street, other graduate students had just moved to the east side, and so consequently the world that had existed was very small, and the nitty-gritty, and before it, Glenn and Ann's, I think maybe Glenn and Ann's closed in 1966 and changed the nitty-gritty. Mary Jo and I heard Muddy Waters sing at the Nitty Gritty to an afternoon crowd of under 30, which was terribly embarrassing to all concerned. But we didn't hang out on campus or in campus areas. We tended to go back home and continue our work from there. And people lived closer in, which would include Jim O'Brien and his friends, very definitely went to the Nitty Gritty when they didn't go to the 602.
Okay.
Which tended to be as important as the Nitty Gritty, maybe more so, and likewise the Green Lantern, which had showed old movies and left-wing students worked meal jobs there, but had some kind of cultural events in the evenings. So as in all other circumstances, I would look with some skepticism about the generalizations in RADS, because factually speaking, the author was often wrong.
Thank you. So, Paul, I want to hit on your memories, if any, of a couple of other major pre-Sterling Hall events.
Uh-huh.
Well, first is the Democratic Convention in Chicago in
68. Uh-huh.
Did you attend?
Tom Hayden, this is a curious memory, and I toss around now and then. In the spring, maybe April or May, he came to campus in order to try to get people to come, to plan to come for the Democratic Convention, and might even have been June. And he seemed to be saying to some people that it was possible to get a peacenik nominee, and therefore it would be a great idea to come. And he seemed to be saying to other people that it was impossible to get a peacenik nominee, and therefore we should come to demonstrate. And between the two of those, I think Mary Jo and I felt that this was going to be a heavy action scene with a lot of potential violence. And we happened to be vacationing in New England, wondering why we weren't in Chicago, I suppose. But we weren't on the scene. And quite a few people from Madison did go down for it, but I wasn't one of them.
Okay. So that was the summer of 68. And then, so fall or academic year 68, 69, then had the Black Strike.
That's right.
In early 69.
Right.
With the seeds of it sort of in late 68.
Uh-huh.
Did you have any involvement in that?
Of course, I and every other TA went on strike, but we felt, as everyone felt, that tactically, strategically, that it was a terrible mistake. It was badly planned. It was rather announced suddenly. It could have been conducted with far more success, and it wasn't quite a debacle, but it was the first step backward following one success after another in terms of mobilization, what it meant to have a strike, what it meant to have effective picket signs, what it meant to win over semi-sympathetic faculty members, or at least make them feel as if they shouldn't cross the picket line, etc. The mobilization of students was much more problematic than a war issue, of course, but it wasn't all that, in my recollection, all that successful. And like everyone I knew, we honored it, but we felt that it wasn't a success.
Okay. So we'll jump ahead then to the next year, which the TAA strike in the spring of 1970. I'm assuming you're TAing at that point.
Indeed. And in that case, it was, in one sense, one of the most dramatic events that I ever experienced on a campus. In fact, in every sense, the most dramatic event I ever experienced on a campus. for several reasons. One was that students in some ways took over their own lives in dormitories. They took on the responsibility of educating themselves, as well as forming their own undergraduate committees to do all sorts of things related to the strike, but were extremely sympathetic to the strike in very large numbers, and more than that, were energetic and interesting and humorous, and, you know, it made for me foreshadow the events of the uprising with spring 2011 because of the mass character of the participation and the good humoredness of the participants. But it's also true that it was extremely well planned. The TAA was very, very effective, right up to the point to what do we do when the university has made clear that they were willing to give in on questions of conditions for teaching assistance, but they were absolutely unwilling to give a single inch in terms of educational reform, which meant that the graduate students would get what we wanted and the undergraduates would not get what they were seeking. It was quite a tense moment. One question was whether teaching assistants should now sit in or take some other kind of nonviolent direct action, which could get a lot of people thrown out of the university and could very well, if we had stepped into a trap, destroy the TAA, or was it time to make a tactical decision to take what we could get and, you know, hope for better next time around? There's several ironies here, and that is several universities, but most notably Brown University, avoided some of the worst of the conflicts by giving into educational reform, and it turned out to be vastly successful. It was a calling card for education for students to go to Brown within 2 or 3 years. But the faculty and the administration at UW were foolishly obdurate, many professors felt their dignity had been insulted in the previous 3 years, in the way that professors can be terribly foolish and egotistic in this respect. And the administration also was unable to respond in a flexible and intelligent way, no doubt pushed by the Board of Regents. So that the TA strike was very effective in terms of student support, in terms of the TAs ourselves, at least within liberal arts and math and some other places. And a union was successfully created, the first one in the nation, which was quite an accomplishment indeed. And a degree of labor sympathy and support with the larger community was created, despite the absolute hostility of the leaders of the Madison Central Labor Council, that is to say, the very reactionary and racist building trades. Some of this is recounted in the SDS comic and also in book that Barry Jo Buell and I put together called It Started in Wisconsin. There's a reflection on that strike back there and what it meant in labor terms with the Teamsters coming to support the teaching assistants, a crucial development. So in many, many ways, it was quite successful and remarkable, and it was as fabulous in a positive way as the bombing of the Army Math Research Center would be fabulous in an utterly negative way 6 months later.
Thank you for that, Paul. Could you maybe, not that there was probably a typical day during the strike, but what sort of things would you do during the course of that TAA strike?
Oh, it was very cold most of the days. But since I wasn't in the leadership of the Teaching Assistants Association, putting out Radical America and all the other activities at the time, I think that the Madison Kaleidoscope that Dave Wagner was editing was just about to appear or had appeared, and I was a lead writer for it under various names. So lots and lots of other things to do. But what I did is I walked the picket lines. and in the course of doing that and keeping our hands warm and so forth, spent a lot of time talking to other people. And I just did my duty as a union member and wouldn't claim more than that, except that I would take every opportunity I could to go in the dorms and talk. And again, as in the aftermath of the police riot at Dow, it was a great moment for students to educate themselves and invite graduate students in to chat with them about what the situation was, what this had to do with the Vietnam War, and a whole series of other issues that were of concern to them.
Thank you. So that the TAA strike ended almost on the heels of then Nixon's press conference about bringing the war, well, announcing that the war was in Cambodia, already was in Cambodia, but he made a formal announcement of it.
Yeah.
And then on the heels of the shootings at Kent State and Jackson State. Do you recall, do you have memories or anecdotes about those?
I think the most interesting thing is this. When we demonstrated at Dow, the police came in with quite brutally, with clubs and a degree of anti-Semitism and a whole bunch of ways in which they considered themselves to be so much in control of the situation or perhaps psychologically threatened that they overreacted to a huge degree. By way of contrast, at the time of the Kent State massacre, or in the aftermath of it, the National Guard was called to campus, and there were young men in uniforms with heavy-duty weapons. But they were the opposite of the Madison police in 1967. They didn't want to be there. They were more friendly than they were supposed to be, and they were in no danger of using those weapons. Nobody was tear gassed, nobody was shot, etc. So that in a way the rules had been established, at least within that world, at the same time as the Madison Police Department, still controlled by essentially a Berger, was involved in cracking down on the marijuana trade while ignoring the heroin trade, putting Madison police into hippie garb, and they would go out and break windows at State Street, and then they would stand around for hours collecting, the uniform police would stand around for hours collecting overtime pay, et cetera, a real degree of political corruption. By contrast to that, the National Guardsmen were unthreatening, on a presence for a few days, but all this was in the wake of Kent State or in relation to Kent State. And I think the horror of the war having come home became more vivid than it had ever been before.
So Paul, during your time here, did you, and I don't recall whether you talked about this during Dow, but did you ever end up being confronted by either Madison Police or the National Guard?
Well, I was at Dow, so I ducked when the club came at me. And Paul Soglin didn't duck as far down as I did, so he got hit on the head. And somebody who'd become one of my closest friends in Providence in the 1970s and 1980s, a guy named Charles Schwartz, had tried to pull a policeman off at beating a co-ed and had been really beaten badly. And a warrant was put out for his arrest. He left town in disguise, never came back to undergraduate school, and so forth and so forth. There's a lot of very bitter memories about that. And by contrast to that, my presence was, benign and so forth. But I want to say one more thing about the earlier question, and that is that by 1970, a large part of blue-collar America was against the war. And that marks a serious contrast to 1967, and we could feel that change on campus.
How... Is there a way you can sort of verbalize that?
No, I would say again, if there was an excuse or rationale for the behavior of the police in 1967, it's that they thought of students as these privileged people who were a bunch of New York Jews and weren't going to have to go to Vietnam and so forth and so forth. In 1970, those National Guardsmen were from blue-collar homes, and they didn't want to be sent to Vietnam either, and they didn't regard themselves. They regarded the rise of youth culture had continued to with music and all kinds of things. So they didn't consider themselves separate and apart from the students. They were just sent there to do something they didn't want to do, but they were almost an extension of ourselves. They just happened to have uniforms on. Whereas in 1967, the line was very clear and marked a lot of hostility. And if there was something in between, of course, it was the Madison firefighters, who were led by a progressive figure who was quite opposed to police misbehavior and would play a central role in pushing Paul Soglin forward to be mayor.
And I can't, do you recall the name of the, I don't have it on the top of my head, the name of the person in charge of the fire department?
Oh, now I'm going to forget.
All right.
It's in my notes. But
yeah, we have.
You have it.
Yeah, we have it.
Later
I just
became head of the fire department. He was head of the firemen's union in 1967 and 1970, but then later he became head of the fire department. And that sharp division of firefighters versus police plays a central role in the changes culturally and politically in Madison from 1967 to 73.
Okay. I had something. I can't think of what I was going to follow up with. So let's
end now and then pick up later.
Yeah, let me make sure to give you space if there are things on your mind about this time period, and we'll end before Sterling Hall. I don't like to end on Sterling
very
Hall,
good.
But is there anything on your mind?
I think that the central observation that I have is that in any number of other university communities around the U.S., and despite the fact that graduate students were going toward the east side and forming our own community there, which played a big role, especially in the TAA, nonetheless, the area around campus in general became a sort of student anti-war countercultural zone. You could say a lot more marijuana was being smoked in that district than in the rest of the city, and that would be accurate. But you could also say that the sentiment on the streets was very anti-war and anti-establishment. And yet at the same time, able to be organized into voting blocks, most emphatically behind Soglin, but also behind other candidates. What had happened was those areas were increasingly occupied by students because the student population was rising so fast that people who lived there before didn't want to pay higher rents. Rents were suddenly higher, so they left. Some of them continued to vote. Most of them didn't bother to vote, but the students in the middle 60s couldn't vote, and people under 21 couldn't vote. So just as the laws were changing, allowing the 18-year-old vote, likewise, Paul Soglin and others were organizing students to be able to vote and to actually vote, so that this was a campus area which was anti-war, counterculture, and beginning to play a real political role in the city. That's what happened that I observed from the distance from the east side, that I could see was playing a very important role in the evolution of Madison politics and Madison culture. Very much resisted and resented by old-style Republicans, but pretty much resisted and resented by Cold War Democrats who wanted the city to be run by the same old real estate crowd, whether they called themselves either Republicans or Democrats, and certainly resisted the rise of Paul Soglin, Eugene Parks, and a group of other progressives, but were beaten back by sheer skill of organization. I didn't observe so much of this myself because it was really taking place as Mary Jo and I were preparing to leave. But by the time we came back for the first summer to do research in 1973, we could see that a lot of it had already taken place and was consolidating itself, and the city was quite different in 1974 than it had been in 1967, and in many, many ways, a far more democratic place.
Paul, I remembered what I was going to ask. So if you have a couple of minutes,
sure.
I don't recall whether I asked you this, but as a, or in the first interview, but as a young white male, I feel compelled to ask you about the draft and the importance of it in, well, in being either on campus or before campus as a young man in the 60s.
Yeah. Well, I had been called to a pre-induction physical in New Haven 6 months before getting to Madison. And I was finally given a 1Y as being politically dangerous or undesirable or something like that, like thousands of others of my type. So it was the central issue at the time, but not central to me personally. I was not going to be drafted. But from the time I got to campus until the time I left, the anxiety of young men with the prospect of being drafted, but no less the anxiety of young women of knowing boyfriends, uncles, family, cousins, and so forth, about that mirrored the growing horror at learning what the U.S. was doing in Vietnam. Those two were bound together, and they created an atmosphere which had never existed, even though the Korean War was unpopular on campus, and everybody was afraid to speak up against it because of the FBI and the fear of repression. But also shaped a great deal that was entirely positive, because people were looking for something that wasn't the death society, but was some different way to look around and live and be different as a new generation.
So, Paul, this will wrap up today,
okay.
And then I'm just going to end this, and then we can chat for a couple minutes if you don't mind.
Sure.
So this concludes the follow-up interview with Paul Buell. Paul, thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Happy to do it.